Today we are going to continue looking at Paul's letter to the Christian communities in Corinth. And partly it's about being emptied in order for transformation to happen. Paul, who was called Saul in Hebrew, was a Jew and a Roman citizen from Tarsus, which is a port on the Mediterranean. Tarsus is now in southeastern Turkey. The name Tarsus was originally Hittite, so it's ancient. The name has equivalents in Greek, Armenian, Hebrew, and Aramaic, which I think reflects the fact that it's been a significant cosmopolitan commercial center over the centuries. It was the place where Antony and Cleopatra first met. During the Roman Empire, it was the capital of the province of Cilicia. It was a place of trade and manufacturing with palaces and places of learning. And Paul grew up there in a devout Jewish family. He was a Pharisee, and he was the son of a Pharisee. And he probably spoke several languages. So he was an educated man. He seems to have been most effective in evangelism to pagans, because he was often chased out of town when he tried to evangelize in synagogues. And yet in Corinth, another cosmopolitan city, he had significant success in converting some of the Jewish population to follow Jesus. But as Douglas Campbell, in the writing that we saw last time, said, Paul's greatest missionary success created his greatest challenges. And this is largely because the converts from the synagogue were different in a number of ways from the street converts, from that earlier street evangelism. There were differences in social class, differences in level of education, different styles of discourse, different ways of engaging with conflicting views, and cultural differences. And while there are clearly many differences between Mediterranean society in the first century and our lives today, it's still worth looking into whether we have anything to learn from those early Christian faith communities. So let's start with these differences in social class in Corinth. In the early 40s, Priscilla and Aquila worked with Paul among the artisans and hand workers in Corinth. These were tough, poor people. But then some of the later Jewish converts were better educated, in higher social status than those former pagans. This created friction, as we saw last time, over the discussion about eating meat that had previously been sacrificed to idols, where the more educated people had rationales for doing that. And Douglas Campbell suggests that a third of the population in the ancient Near East lived in constant hunger. So that probably those first converts didn't know where the next meal was coming from. A third probably had enough resources to be secure of food for a couple of weeks. But by contrast, the elite were wealthy and well-connected. Fabulously wealthy in the eyes of those hand workers. So imagine a cross-section like that in this church. How would we handle it? And then education. People in the Greco-Roman cities loved appearances. They were infatuated by money, education, and connections. We think that in the US we have a celebrity culture. Well, we do. But we probably learnt it from those ancient Greeks. Professionals in rhetoric could command huge fees and keep people spellbound for hours. Paul was educated, but in the more provincial setting of Jerusalem than in one of the more prestigious places. He could use scripture, he could argue a case, but he made his living with his hands, a tent maker. And in order to make his case about Jesus and the message of Jesus, he downplayed his education and his background. We heard in the first passage that Celia led that he deliberately emptied himself of rhetoric and confidence to make a point, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on the power of God. He's emptied himself of ego so that the readers can use different eyes and a different perception to see how God works. And that turns the prevailing social order on its head, the success culture, the glamour, and so on. Paul was not relying on cleverness or powers of rhetoric and persuasion. And perhaps inevitably this led to questioning among the elite of his congregation. Is he up to the job? Is he the sort of person we want to lead us? How do we assess people? Do we see beyond the outward appearance, particularly those people who exercise spiritual authority? What's important to us? So, moving on to the ways in which we talk to each other and disagree with each other. I don't know about you, but in the last few weeks, some of us have been identifying with Eagles or Patriots, even if we don't usually follow football. After the Eagles' win in the Super Bowl, there was a post on Facebook saying, "Mary Dyer avenged." And Mary Dyer, for those who didn't grow up Quaker, who is one of our martyrs, was hanged by the Puritans on Boston Common because she refused to go away and not remonstrate with them. So a game with a ball 2 weeks ago became a pointer to Puritan persecution and Quaker martyrdom, with the underdogs finally getting to have their day. And if you've ever lived in Philadelphia, you know how important that is. In the ancient Greek culture, those rock star philosophers and exponents of rhetoric functioned as mentors and all had their different followings. This developed beyond inspirational pep talks and followership into almost tribal proportions. And with this tribalism came noisy rivalry. We're followers of this guy, not that guy, and so on. And this fan following and its noisy behavior got into the early church in Corinth. And Paul points out to the factionalism in the way in which the members of the church have formed rival camps as followers of himself or of his co-worker Apollos. There's nothing in this text to suggest that Apollos was trying to upstage Paul, but it seems that the fans were trying to create that competition. But people who love one another and work to build little plots of heaven where they're situated don't create factions or indulge in partisan disputes, and they certainly shouldn't slander rival leaders. A characteristic of the inequality in Corinth and in other areas of the Mediterranean world was that those who'd climbed to the top held on to position. They were competitive, aggressive, and pretty ruthless. And guess what? They didn't check those values when they came into church. They mocked and denigrated the competition, they strove for attention, and they jockeyed for position. It sounds to me very much like some of the water in which we swim in the US. And I don't see the surrounding political culture getting more compassionate for a while. So how can we as the church become countercultural? One of the problems that faith communities have is their permeability to absorbing the values of the surrounding culture. Even as we think we don't, it just happens. So I grew up in a state church, that's what the Church of England is, where it was normal to display the national flag and the flag of the British Legion in the sanctuary, and the war memorial plaques all around the walls conflated, mixed together, fighting for the Queen, or fighting for Queen and country, with fighting for God. And in many ways, particularly if you've got a state church, it's really impossible to unravel church and state. And I think we import the values and habits of the world into our places of worship without being conscious of what we're doing. And there are times when we even take on the trappings of worldly privilege. In my travels for Friends World Committee for Consultation, I visited a yearly meeting in another country where the presiding clerk had a vehicle for traveling between churches. It made sense there. But this was a clan-based culture where people had very little, and most people could never afford to own a vehicle. So being presiding clerk carried with it a privilege, something that was a temporary perk to the presiding clerk's family. And that yearly meeting began to have trouble with presiding clerks being reluctant to rotate off when their time was up. So care had to be taken to set up a rota where the position and the vehicle that went with it rotated between a small number of families in that yearly meeting. And there were only a small number of families. And so I think that was an extreme case of faith and culture being bound together. And as I said last time, it's pretty clear that left on its own, a broad call to loving doesn't work. It's a critical foundation, because without that foundation of love and acceptance and genuine care, the structure can't begin to be built. But there also has to be some serious self-examination, individually and together, and then some conscientious and deliberate work for the community to thrive and answer its call. So Paul had his hands full in Corinth. He's a countercultural evangelist presenting a countercultural God story. Not only is he not acceptable to some of the elitists in the church, his descriptions of God are unpalatable to them too. He describes a God who comes to earth, to a small backwater, not a sophisticated city, who becomes human, who works with his hands, and is crucified by the authorities. He describes a God who turns their world upside down, and a God who includes many whom the church members would ignore, marginalize, or despise. So the elite in that congregation were not going along with this. Empty themselves, act like servants, live alongside the artisans and manual workers in the congregation. So we can see how some of them began to undermine him and continue to despise those who they regarded as their social inferiors. It was just in the water. What kind of leadership does a faith community need? I'm not referring to what today we would call pastoral leadership. It's part of it. I'm talking about moral leadership. People who set examples by bridging these social chasms. People who lead lives of integrity, who encourage others, and who have the courage to address behavior that's not Christ-like when that's needed. Quakers were deeply countercultural, which got them into hot water with the high church and the Puritans. They didn't invent these ways of challenging the existing order. They were building on the work of earlier Christian groups like the Waldensians and the Anabaptists. Their rejection of religious hierarchy and their belief that God could and did speak through an extraordinarily wide range of people, and their deep faith that a truly gathered meeting for business could, in the quiet, discern God's will without a great hierarchy of church officials, was astonishing both in its simplicity and also its power. Even today, it requires those who are in the habit of taking charge to be still and listen, to make space for faltering voices and tentative questions. And above all, just as Paul tried to empty himself, it requires all who are gathered to discern God's will for a faith community to empty themselves of attachments, of preconceived ideas, and of fears and anxieties, and trust that in the quiet waiting, God will give someone the words that the community needs.